Today is April 28th, 2016. My name is Rob Mason, and I'm the Student Project Coordinator for the Albert School of Law History Project. Joining me today is Martin Taylor. Welcome, Mr. Taylor.
Thank you.
So let's begin by discussing your background a little bit. Where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in England during the Second World War. I was shunted around, you know, because we were meant to be kept out of harm's way. But I spent a fair bit of it close to London, so I heard lots of bombings and V1s. The V2s you didn't hear.
Wow.
We were the luckiest people, of course. Most of the rest of Europe was far worse off.
What do you remember any specific experiences like that? How old were you around that time?
Well, when the war started, I would have been 8. And I was immediately sent off to the country, and in the end to a boarding school. And thereafter I came home only during holidays. You know. My mother was in the army. My father was in the Home Guard. yes, it was an interesting time to grow up.
So when did you come to Canada then?
Yeah, well, I came to Canada, I left, I was 21 when I left, and 22 when the ship docked, and in New York, and then I went to Toronto.
And what prompted that that move?
Well, you don't have to have a reason when you're 21, you know, to move somewhere, to go somewhere, but I did have a brother who was in Canada.
Okay.
Yes.
So that was exciting then? There was a bit of an adventure?
Yeah, it was an extraordinary adventure. I mean, I remember particularly the we were in the steerage in the Queen Elizabeth. We were in, right in the bow, where you, the side of the cabin was the rake of the bow. And it went up and down like an elevator. When we got to New York and it docked, we saw these cars roaring by on an elevated highway, and they were all brilliant new colors. It was an entirely different world from the one that I'd left, which was still in the grips of austerity. You know. A tremendous experience.
Did you ever plan on, did you plan on staying in Canada when you moved?
Well, you don't really have those sort of plans, do you, at the age of 21?
Fair enough.
I didn't know. I was prepared to go where fate took me. And at that time, when I came to Canada, I had worked as a newspaper person for 4 years, I guess, five, on in Fleet Street, later in Leeds, and most recently at Heathrow Airport before I left.
So what did you start doing when you were in Toronto?
Well, I went looking for a job, and I was told at one of the newspaper offices, oh, there are half a dozen of you, like you, on every boat from the UK. And so I couldn't get a job on a paper in Toronto. So I went to the headquarters of the Thompson Organization, which, of course, in those days owned a large number of smaller daily papers. And they said, can you do a police beat? I was asked. Well, I had no idea, of course, what it involved. So I said, yes, oh, yes, because I was young. And and you think you can do anything. So they said, fine, well, you can go to Sarnia, Ontario, and you can be the police reporter there on that paper there. And so I did that for a while.
Did that expose you to the law then? Is that,
oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, it exposed me to two things. One, the way of the world in Canada and North America. It also exposed me to the law for the first time. I was very impressed with what I saw. The law was administered under very difficult circumstances in a town that was full of construction and displaced people from Europe. And the magistrate's court was in the basement of the city hall. There was no air conditioning. And the magistrate there conducted the proceedings with all the decorum and the care, the punctilio that you would find at the Central Criminal Court in London. I was very impressed, and I got to know a number of the lawyers there, and so yes, I got very interested in the law.
And did you go? Did you do an undergraduate degree before going?
No, I didn't. No, and then I went back to England and worked on a weekly newspaper called the Canada Review. Mm. And then I came back again, and I got a job with the Canadian Press, which is a cooperative news service, which is owned by all the daily newspapers in those days, all of them. And they shared the costs of the cooperative. And I worked for them in Toronto. There was a one-person bureau in Windsor, Ontario, that I occupied for a while. And then they sent me out to Vancouver to cover, I think, the second W.A.C. Bennett election. I can't remember, but they needed somebody for an election. And so that's how I first came here.
Wow.
Yes.
So what made you decide to go to law school then?
Well, I've told you, I developed a great interest in the law, particularly as a result of my experiences in Sarnia. Mm-hmm. And the one day I was sent out here to interview Dr. McKenzie, Norman McKenzie, the president of UBC. And I took advantage of the occasion to ask him why it was necessary to have an arts degree in order to study for a profession. And he said, well, what profession are you interested in? I said, well, I'd very much like to study law, but it'd be very difficult for me to do it if I have to spend 4 years doing arts. Well, he said, listen, you sign up for grade 13 by correspondence, which was the equivalent then of first year arts. Mm. And he said, you can do that while you're doing your job. And then he said, you come out here in a couple of summer schools, you'll have second year, and then you can get into law school as long as you've got 65 degree average. But he said, hurry, because it's not going to last. So I did that, and actually I did one summer school, and then I did some of the regular session courses and managed to get the 2 years arts. Well, I first did the grade 13 by correspondence, and then I did what I just told you, and right. I got into law school. I thought it was absolutely miraculous. I was sitting in the law class there. I believe when the class started out, there were three women, 112 men, and a dog in the class. Unfortunately, the owner and the dog decided to pursue another discipline, and so we didn't have their company after the first year. But the number that graduated were the three women and 72 men, I think. Mm. So we lost a lot, more, I think, than you would today.
Yeah.
But it was much easier to get in.
Mm. Did you find it was more competitive once you were in law school then, with that high of an attrition rate?
Yes. Well, I think people went into law school not knowing quite what they wanted to do, some of them. Nowadays, I'm sure they know exactly what they want to do when they get into law. And so some went on to other different disciplines. Were the examinations very tough? Well, I don't think so. I suspect that today they probably are more difficult than they were then.
So what was your law school curriculum like?
Well, my recollection is that I can only remember one option that we had, and that was either admiralty law or municipal law. Mm. There may have been another, but I don't recall it. So I remember I took municipal law. I couldn't imagine doing shipping. And now I wish I had taken shipping. I would like to have taken both.
That was your only choice, though?
I think so.
Really?
Yes, oh. I think so.
And of those courses, which were you drawn to, of the ones that were mandatory?
Well, I was, of course, very interested in the constitutional law. and torts, of course. Both of them have a large historical element, and although it's become customary in Canada to think of the Constitution as written law, it isn't, of course. It's partly written and very large part is common law, and that's true in England too, that some of it is written,
right,
and some of it is the common law of the Constitution. Anyway, they're both very interesting subjects to me.
And did those carry through your career?
Yes, yes, yes. Only I've not had an opportunity to either argue or decide in many constitutional cases, though I think I did do some charter cases when I was on the bench. But my interest in tort, I will explain to you in a moment.
Sure. Did UBC Law provide you with adequate professional opportunities?
Yes, well, I had no difficulty in getting a job. Now, I kept working for the Canadian Press throughout the time I was at law school. I worked for them on weekends, and sometimes when it was during the week, at night after law school. So I was very busy, you know. And then when I got articles, they allowed me to continue to work on weekends, the benches did. So I entered the bar without any student debt, which would be unthinkable today, I believe. But I don't believe there was any student loans available. I never had heard of it. Though Dean Walter Gage used to be very helpful in getting bursaries for people who had financial difficulties, but I had a job, so I was able to do it on my own.
So you mentioned that during law school you worked part-time in the newspaper business.
Yes, yes.
What sort of work were you doing? Were you able to draw on what you were learning in law school in what you were writing?
No, I don't believe that I ever was able to do that. But I used to work Saturdays and Sundays, but particularly Saturdays. And my work was mostly editing material. You see, the way it works is that the newspapers would give to Canadian Press a copy of all the stories that they had written. And we would then make them understandable to people in other parts of Canada who didn't have the background of the local coverage, and they weren't interested in having stories that might run every day here. They would perhaps once a week round up that story and hope that you could make people in Toronto interested in it. The Toronto papers were mostly interested in the march of the Sons of Freedom, the Doukhobors, and also in the wanted pictures of the emperor penguins in the zoo. There were other things they were interested in, but those I remember particularly.
So what did you do after graduating from law school?
Well, I was very lucky to get articles with Charles Brazier, QC, who was a man of a very good judgment and great courtesy at Davison Company. And he treated me with the same courtesy that he showed to his clients. I was never treated in any way but with the almost consideration by him, and my association with him, I was able to learn a lot that was helpful to me later. And so when after I was called, I continued to work with him until one day he started to say to me, well, you better take this case yourself, you know. And that's how I got into law.
So how long did you work with him then?
I would think for perhaps 6 or 7 years. 1 year I went and practiced in Prince George, and I learned a lot about that, and then I came back again and resumed what I was doing.
What was different between practice back then compared to today?
I find that very difficult to say. I mean, the obvious things, for instance, that you got always had a pile of pink telephone calls notes that you've been given people to call back. You never see that today, or very rarely, because of email. Were the carbon copies? I think there were. You know, there were these obvious things. There was no fax. There was teletype. There were all those obvious things. But you're really interested in what was it like. And I can't say how it would differ from today, except possibly it wasn't so organized, you know. And the billing practices were different. As you'll know, today the hourly billing is dominates the practice, and that's how big clients want it.
Right.
As I understand it. Well, if they didn't, it wouldn't happen that way. But in the old days, a bill reflected, was expected to reflect what had been done, what had been accomplished, how much skill was involved, the importance to the client. You tried to come up with a round figure, and
right.
the means of the client,
right.
and all these things, and you tried to come up with a fair figure, and perhaps the time involved played a role in it, but it wasn't the dominant role that it's become now, as a result, I believe, of the wishes of the clients, the big clients.
Do you think that by not taking means into account as much now, that maybe it's become too or more rigid than before?
Well, no, you see, because there's always been a great deal of work that has been done without charge by lawyers, and it's little understood generally. That I believe, though I may be wrong in this, that there is no other calling in which so much work is done without charge as by lawyers among professionals who have no guaranteed income, who are reliant entirely on the fees
right.
that they receive. And I know that a lot of salaried people do a lot of extra work, and teachers particularly. But among people who are reliant for their livelihood on what they're able to bill,
right.
I don't believe any would do as much work without charge as lawyers do.
That's a good point, yeah. So what were your experiences like as a judge?
As a judge, well, what happened was after I'd been 15 years in practice, which is not very long, I was asked by the Minister of Justice if I would accept an appointment to the bench. And in those days, you certainly didn't apply for it, couldn't apply for it, and I most certainly wouldn't. I wouldn't have thought myself qualified at all. It was at an interesting time when the appointments to the bench were no longer made on a vacancy-by-vacancy basis, but the Minister of Justice, Mr. Trudeau, and later Mr. Turner, they appointed an assistant whose whole job was to go across the country and find out names of people who lawyers thought might be appropriate to be appointed. And there was no committee. And then when vacancy came up, the minister had some names. And so he was able to get advice from an independent source, not from a political source, in making his decisions, and somebody thought that I could do the job, so I was very surprised to find myself in that very responsible position, a position of immense trust, and I felt greatly honored, of course.
Do you feel that you developed any particular areas of specialty as a judge?
As a judge, no. One is thrown into the whole array of problems that you have to deal with in the courtroom. And my experience had been, I'd done criminal work, I'd done pro bono criminal work, but never had done a jury trial or anything of that sort. And So that was very new to me, and I had to quickly learn. I devoted a couple of weeks to studying the criminal code in all my spare time, which wasn't much. And then you take whatever comes your way. That's the great challenge of it. Mm. And I've heard it said that among the many birthrights of an Englishman is the right to be tried by an amateur. Which is not quite true, because certainly the person who's acting as judge is a professional, but not necessarily a specialist.
Right.
That's the point.
The other thing I noticed is that struck me is you served as ethics commissioner for the 2010 Vancouver Olympics.
Yes, I did.
How did that role come about?
Well, I was asked to be the I forget how it was put, but I'll put it the deputy to Chief Justice McEachran, who retired. He was the ethics commissioner, and then when he died, I was asked to take over the job.
I see.
That's exactly how it happened. He left the bench sometime after I did. And so I just did the last 2 years, perhaps, of it.
And what sort of issues did you deal with in that role?
Well, the problems that the job was meant to take care of were essentially conflict of interest problems. Mm-hmm. And they had very few of them. So it wasn't a sinecure, because a sinecure, you get paid for doing nothing. And I got not paid for doing very little.
So you organized a number of events associated with the Donahue v. Stevenson case, or the Paisley Snail case, as it's also known.
Yes.
Could you tell me what led to your special interest in that case?
Yes, I'm most pleased to tell you about it. When we came to plan our 20th reunion, you see, this is the class of 1962, so 1982, some of us thought, well, what can we do to make this a special event and not just a get-together of a bunch of old friends? And then suddenly it occurred to us that this was the 50th anniversary of the decision in Donahue and Stevenson. And so we thought, right, let's have a Donahue and Stevenson festival. And so we arranged a debate between Mr. Justice Alan Lyndon, who's the author of Lyndon on Torts, the leading Canadian, no, I mustn't say that, one of the leading Canadian Torts texts, had a debate with Professor Joe Smith of the faculty here. Mr. Justice Lyndon said that Donahue and Stevenson was like a skyrocket bursting in the midnight sky, the seed of an oak tree, and so on. And Professor Smith said that it had been taken far too far, and that it was compelling people to act like good Samaritans or something along those lines. So we had this debate. We had a jury which was made to make up their mind whether it had been taken too far. Mm. And Lord Denning had said, sometimes I think that too much is being done for the sufferer. And so the question was, is too much being done for the sufferer? And I don't remember what the verdict was. It really didn't matter. Yeah. But anyway, we had a very lively debate. And the paper that Professor Smith gave, which he had written along with Dean, as he later became, Peter Burns, that paper, both of the papers appeared in the UBC Law Review for November 1983. But that paper by Joe Smith and Dean Burns was also reproduced in the Modern Law Review, I believe, one of the principal legal journals in London, and it was referred to with approval in the House of Lords.
Mm. Wow.
And so from a very early point, our little show that we put on here in 1982 developed into something very much larger. And one of the things we did there in 1982 for our reunion was I wrote a letter to, what happened was, I looked, who were the solicitors at the end of the report in the appeal cases? There is the name of the solicitors, and it said Walter J. Leachman, solicitor for the pursuer, Bate Donahue. So I looked up in the Scottish law list, which we had in the law library at the courthouse, for that name, and there was the name Walter G. Leachman, and underneath was named John Leachman. In other words, that was the name of this one-man firm, and the one-man lawyer was now John. I thought, that has to be his son. So I wrote a letter to him, and I sent him an interrogatory, which said, you know, did you ever meet May Donahue, which was ridiculous, because he would, at that time, have been a student. He wouldn't have been, wasn't actually in practice.
Okay.
And of course I asked him, did you see the bottle, which was ludicrous. And, and but more importantly, what did your father think about the case? And he told me that his father thought that the House of Lords would be more favorable to May Donahue's interests than had been the court of session in Scotland, which had previously rejected a very similar claim by on behalf of two young people who claimed to have found a mouse in a bottle. And they found that this was not evidence of negligence. That's my recollection of what it was about. Anyway, and he was a very interesting man. Walter Leachman, father, was an alderman, Glasgow City alderman. And as a result of this contact with John Leachman, he, God bless him, he got in touch with some people in Paisley, some wonderful ladies who had a society called the Old Paisley Society, were trying to protect the history of the town. And they went to work and they found the site, not just the site of the cafe, but pictures. We found, they got us two pictures of the cafe, wow, long gone. By then, it was knocked down about 1952, so 30 years earlier it had gone, but they got these pictures, and they checked the city directories going back to the late 20s, and they confirmed that indeed there was a Minchella that owned the cafe and so on. So they were able to verify all the important facts of the case, and at that point it had been said that none of this really happened, that it was all fabricated in order to get this issue before the House of Lords. We were able to put to rest all of that nonsense, and we were able to confirm that there was a May Donahue and there was a Wellmeadow cafe, and it did belong to Mr. Minchella. And John Leachman said there is no way that his father would have brought that action without having interviewed not only May Donahue, but also the innominate friend who ordered the ginger beer that was found out, and satisfying himself, as a good solicitor would, that they were telling the truth. Right. And so we were able to... And of course, this is at the sort of last moment. John died a few years later. And oh, yes, we found the Minchella family. They found the Minchella family. I mustn't say we. And so so we thought, well, this thing simply cannot stop here. And so in 1990, or 1982 was when we had our show out here for our 20th anniversary. 1990, the Canadian Bar had their annual meeting in London, and so we thought, this is the moment. And so we asked these good ladies in Paisley, would you be willing to help us to put on a world negligence conference in Paisley, that we will try and get our people to come up from London when the conference is over. And they said, sure, okay, or oh, hi. And they did it. They did it for us. We got patrons, a long list of the most distinguished patrons. And Dean Burns put together an academic program. He got the leading people in the world in the field of torts to give papers on the law of negligence as it had developed. And this conference took place just weeks after a case called Murphy had, the House of Lords reversed its decision in Anne's and the Merton Borough Council. London Merton Borough Council. Mm. And Murphy was against another London Borough Council whose name I, of course, can't remember. Anyway, so this was a seismic event in the law of torts, and for the House of Lords to actually reverse itself after, I think, 12 years. Mm. And rejected the notion that there's a general duty of care that goes beyond the duty to take care not to cause physical damage and personal injury and goes into the area of pure economic loss. And of course, that was not a workable concept. Mm. And they rejected it, and now pure economic loss is recoverable only in certain specific cases. And obviously that has to be so, because the whole free enterprise system operates on the basis of people pursuing their own interests, which will often cause economic loss to others,
right.
And knowing that it's going to do it. And how could you possibly impose a general duty on other people not to cause accidental economic loss when those engaged in the struggle of the free market do it deliberately? And how could you stop them doing it deliberately without destroying the economic system that the public has chosen to prefer? And so this is a very interesting moment in the history of the law of torts, when the concept of a general duty going beyond physical damage to property and personal injury was rejected, the idea that that the duty went beyond that. Anyway, so we got Professor Houston, the editor of Salmon on Tort, Professor Fleming, the author of Fleming on Tort, Mr. Justice Lyndon, the author of Lyndon on Tort, Mr. Justice Brennan of the High Court of Australia, who later became Chief Justice of Australia. They all gave papers. Mm-hmm. And the Lord Chancellor, Lord Mackay of Clashford, he very kindly came up and presided at a a presentation again of the great debate between Mr. Justice Lyndon and Professor Joe Smith, which Joe Smith wrote a poem after the style of the Canterbury Tales. And we call it a pilgrimage to Paisley. That's why, that's how that kind of came into it. Yes, yeah.
Right.
And what happened was that the papers took a day and a half to deliver at the town hall. And when that was finished, we all paraded through the high street from the town hall up to the site of the cafe. And these very good people in Paisley had managed to secure the site for 50 years, I think, to be a park. Mm. And we put up a plaque there that was jointly from the Canadian Bar and the Faculty of Advocates of Scotland and the Law Society of Scotland, recording what had happened there on that site. And Lord Mackay, the Lord Chancellor, he dedicated the park, and he said, this is where it all happened, or it didn't. Anyway, it was unbelievable. But the day that they took me, these ladies in Paisley took me to the site, you know, and I looked at it, The air was just full of electricity. You think, my goodness, you know, this is where it happened. Or as Lord Mackay said, or it didn't. But I think our inquiries satisfy us that it did happen. There was something in the bottle.
So you were also involved in production of television docudramas regarding this case as well.
Well, yes. And then what happened? When we came back, the papers that were presented at Paisley reproduced in this volume called Donoghue and Stevenson and the Modern Law of Negligence. It was edited by Dean Burns. The Paisley papers, beautiful cover with the Paisley pattern. And it's full of pictures. It's very unusual. It's a law book with pictures in, you know, which should make it very attractive to everybody. When they get to this in first year law, there are several copies in the library here. And so we said, well, we've seen the show, we've read the book, we've got to make the movie. And that, I thought, what we would do there was to get some of the video stuff, videos that had been made of the, particularly of the parade. Oh, we had a big pipe band, the best in Scotland, led the parade. And we had the last evening, the provost, the mayor, gave a banquet. And we were entertained by a tenor who performed under the title The Singing Solicitor, who was the leading, the ranking Scottish tenor. I'm eager that you should have all these details. Anyway.
Great.
So I thought, well, if we could splice together, you know, the videos of the parade and of the provost's show at the banquet and a few of these other things, that would... I should have mentioned there were two members of the Supreme Court of Canada as well.
Oh, really?
In the parade. And, of course, the Chief Justice of Scotland, the Lord Chancellor.
Okay, so let's move on to just a more general question. Do you have any advice for law students today?
Yes. Well, yes. That's the most important thing. You see, my experience of the law was always as doing counsel work, as a litigator. So I can only speak of that field, and the difficulty that you have today is in getting experience in the court, in the courtroom. And students today, the most important thing for them to do is to try and get articles with somebody, if they're interested in litigation, with somebody who will take them to court, not just to let them do research, you know, and write factums. And so it's very important that you try and get articles somewhere where you're going to have the opportunity to go to court often. And after call, you know, one of the ways of being in court most frequently is by working in the Crown Prosecutor's office. Mm-hmm. You know, and that's a good thing to do. But I would say, because I don't have much time, the students are well paid today, or reasonably well paid. They certainly weren't in my day. And so they're expected to produce some return. But what I would love to say to them is, in your free time, just go to the courthouse and sit and listen. There's not much opportunity for that, and that's what they should do. So you ask me what would be my advice. It is that, it's to get in there. You can't imitate other people. You can only do it your own way.
Right.
But you can see how the best people do it, and it helps you so much in developing your own style of advocacy. I think that's the most important thing with people going in. But the other thing is, of course, who you learn from is so important. And the thing that helped me, because I was never a great advocate, I did some interesting work in the short time, 15 years, when I was in practice before I went on the bench. But I had training in writing, you know. Mm. And in the economic use of words is right. very, very important in the newspaper business. And it's very important if you have, if you're permitted 30 pages for your fact, do it in 15. You know. Don't take 5 points. Take 2 or 3 at the most. Preferably only one. You know. Now, the way I was trained in newspapers was helpful to me in that, in the economic use of other people's time in reading.
Right. Yeah.
For and yourself. Then, it may take you a lot longer to write a 15-page fact sure. than to write a 30-page one, where you just yeah. throw everything in. But it's time very well spent.
And as a judge, did you appreciate it when that approach has been taken?
Well, yes, because you're very, very busy, you know, all the time. When I was on the Court of Appeal, we would sit for 2 weeks, and then we would have only 1 week for writing judgments and reading all the material for the next 2 weeks.
Right.
So you're very appreciative of someone who's able to put down in a short compass what this case is about.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court of Canada judges will always say the factum is so important. So those are the two things. Writing is to train yourself in the economic use of the English language, and to get into court and watch how the people who do it best do it.
Right. So final thought here. What would you say is the proudest accomplishment of your career? Or one of them, if you can't think of just one.
Well, I suppose, what can I say? I was profoundly honored, you know, to have been asked to sit on the court. I was, after all, an immigrant. I hadn't been here. I'd been here only how long? Well, not very long. And I'd only been in practice for 15 years, so it was a real challenge. I was very flattered indeed to be asked. I felt it was a great honor. I also thought it was a great responsibility, and I did it for 17 years. I don't know, pride is not what I would quite apply to it, but there it was. I came here as a newspaper reporter, and I was profoundly honored to be asked to do that tremendously difficult job. And then, after I retired from the court here, I was very fortunate to be appointed to a part-time position on the Court of Appeal for the Cayman Islands. These appointments are made in London because the Cayman Islands is what we would think of as a colony, in the sense that its government is similar to ours before we came into Confederation.
Right.
And so the judiciary is appointed in London, the police is controlled from London, the budget is controlled from London, the governor is appointed from London, and the appeal from the Court of Appeal to Cayman Islands, well, for the Cayman Islands, was to the Privy Council in London. Mm-hmm. And that was very, very interesting, because I found there that the style of advocacy was different. They speak the same legal language, and they will use the same cases, you see, from England cited here, but of course there are differences in the statute of law, but there are also very interesting differences in the manner in which cases are presented. They don't have factums, they don't have appeal books. The oral advocacy is what it's all about. Mm. There are very able lawyers there, and also came from London to argue some of the cases, the larger cases, because they get very much larger cases there than you would ever get here, because of it being a financial center.
Right.
International financial center. And I found that work very interesting indeed, to see the difference, the subtle differences, you know, in the way the cases are presented. And they do. We have a factum, it's an interesting word, a factum that is follows very closely a pattern that's laid down by the rules. They will provide you, not always, but often, with what they call a skeleton argument. It covers, it follows no particular form or pattern. It can be 5 pages or 25 or whatever, and it will, the counsel will just tell you what he or she thinks you need to read ahead of time, but it's not much.
Interesting.
The style there is, well, just listen, you know, and I'll explain it to you. It's very interesting. The word factum, you know, I looked it up once. It's not used in the United States. It's not used in England. It's described in the dictionary as being a French expression. And I like to think, though I'm probably quite wrong, they may have been introduced by a judge in Quebec who perhaps was familiar with it as part of the French law.
Something to look into.
It's definitely a Canadian expression. Canadian and French.
Interesting.
It is, yes, it really is. So, yeah, so I had that very interesting experience there for 7 years when I went down there. We went down there 17 times, I think, and to hear things done a little differently than we do them here. Better, I don't know, but different. So that was a very interesting experience that I had indeed.
Any more final thoughts before we conclude?
Well, yes. You see, what I hope might happen, and I have no way of making it, doing anything further toward it myself, is that in 2018, that's just 2 years away, that'll be the 90th anniversary of the visit of May Donoghue to the Belmeadow Cafe. And in 2022 will be the 90th anniversary of the decision of the House of Lords. And both of those, either of those, could be taken up for another such event as we had in 1982. And you might say, well, why the 90th anniversary? Well, the answer to that is in preparation for going to Paisley for the 100th anniversary, which would be in 2028 or 2032, depending on whether it's the 100th anniversary of the event or the 100th anniversary of the decision.
Right.
Because the law of torts is constantly changing. It's the most classic example of the development of the common law. And such an event as that could attract the leading scholars in the world, as it has done before for us. And I think that UBC Law has a rightful claim to a special interest in this extraordinary case. As a result of the event, not what we did, but what happened as a result of what we started. And it simply snowballed, it took off, you know. And I think it would do so again because there's been a lot more developments. Now, I must tell you that in 2012, the University of the West of Scotland put on a similar program to the one we put up on in 1990. And they attracted, again, some of the leading scholars to Paisley. And I see it as on the 100th anniversary, it will be a wonderful thing if UBC Law and the University of the West of Scotland could mount the a proper celebration of the centenary of this extraordinary case and the impact that it's had on the law. I don't say that the case itself has the case itself started something which has gone on and which will go on forever, in my opinion, in the development of the proper rules of the time to govern people in a civilized society in their dealings with others. It's a source, I believe, of continuing fascination for anybody who's interested in the law. And what we're dealing with now is the progeny of Donahue and Stevenson rather than the case itself.
Right.
All the spin-offs that have developed from it. It would be a wonderful thing if, by any chance, another class would be interested in taking this on. And I do hope that that might happen.
Well, thank you so much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
Thank you.